Hello, this is Heath Brown for the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, we have the pleasure to hear from Mitch Solenberger and Mark Rozelle. We'll be talking to Mitch about their book, The President's Czars, Undermining Congress and the Constitution. This is a 2012 publication from the University of Kansas Press. It's a really interesting book and take on the presidency from the public law perspective. I think that everyone's going to enjoy the book if you have the chance to read it, and I hope we'll enjoy hearing from Mitch. Welcome to New Books in Political Science. Today we have the pleasure to speak with Mitch Solenberger, who's the author of the new book, The President's Czars, Undermining Congress and the Constitution. Mitch has written the book with Mark Rozelle and is here today. Welcome, Mitch.
Thank you for having me.
Mitch, before we get started on this really interesting book, maybe you can talk a little bit about yourself and maybe the bigger picture of where this book comes from, whether it's from a larger project or from graduate work, or where is this in your career?
Well, it's really the second stage of my research, or second step to my research. You know, my dissertation was born out of my work at the Congressional Research Service on judicial appointments and the confirmation process in general. And from my dissertation, I had published a book titled The President Shall Nominate. And then a lot of my early work has been in the area of appointments since then. This is kind of an offshoot of my work at Congressional Research Service, is sort of my subset work, which was really administrative law type studies of the executive branch. And I was increasingly curious with how executive branch structure was formed and how rules and regulations were promulgated, which again led me, at least in grad school, my administrative law interest and obviously public law interest in general. So really it's just that kind of offshoot of the practical workings of Congress and my dealings with Congress as an analyst at Congressional Research Service. And that was about a decade ago, I would say.
Yeah, and tell me about the collaboration with Mark Rozelle.
You know, working with Mark is great. I recommend for any young scholar to find a more experienced person that they can co-author with. And, you know, when you're frustrated with the ins and outs of the review process, you know, journal submissions, that type of thing, you can, you know, kind of vent to that person or at least ask questions about, you know, what happens next, you know, and that was great with Mark. Mark has... I've benefited with my collaborations with Mark because he does have more experience with, you know, with the academic publishing circles, and he brings a different perspective than I had, particularly since I started off my career not really in academia. I was working, again, at Congressional Research Service, so I think I have a different view of things than he does and some others do.
With that in mind, let's turn to the book and to the preface. You don't start the book, but you start the writing, what the first thing that someone would read, with a bold statement about your method. So you write, "The analysis in this book is contrary to trends in political science scholarship and conventional wisdom about the presidency." What do you mean by this?
Well, there's a couple of points there. I think the first is the, and this is something that I guess dates back to the methods debates of, I guess, the 50s and 60s when the behavioralist era really took hold, and what we saw was this, for lack of a better word, a downgrading of a focus on public law itself. And that's what we're speaking to, or at least one of the elements we're speaking to, is the need to focus political science, you know, not a complete focus, but at least to have an appreciation for its public law roots. and it's something that we've somewhat lost. And I do realize, and I make this point in the preface, that there are certainly public law scholars that are doing great work out there. But historical institutionalism within public law isn't dominant, and it certainly isn't a focus of a lot of scholars' works.
The method, though you describe it as contrary to the trends, makes for a very readable book, and so I think that on a methods level, but also how that translates to the actual writing of the book, turned out very well.
I got to say too that there's a number of scholars out there that that created foundational work or wrote foundational work that made this book possible. I mean, it really wouldn't have 10, 20 years ago, I don't think a study of this nature would have been at all possible without the secondary work. I'm thinking of Matthew Dickinson, even Lou Fisher, who we mentioned in the preface. He's written a lot on the relationship between the president and Congress, and we kind of stand on the shoulders of giants, that kind of cliche.
Was this a case that you had to make to University of Kansas Press? Did they buy into the premise early on, or was the case one that you had to convince them of?
No, I think they saw the scholarly merit in a study of executive branch czars. I mean, the term itself is relatively amorphous, so what happened in terms of the dialogue between us in Kansas was we offered the book proposal and they sent it out for review, and then the reviewers came in relatively positive on it. Obviously, a lot of methodological concerns, particularly again because we, as part of our vernacular, czars wasn't there within political science, so there was some heavy lifting we had to do there. But it was all contingent on us returning a final manuscript to go out again for peer review. So, at each step of the way, they were somewhat skeptical, but at the same time, they were receptive that somebody would write on this topic.
Yeah. So let's get to the sort of the meat of the book. And you begin the book by talking about Kenneth Feinberg.
Yes.
Who is he, and why is he so important?
Well, Kenneth Feinberg is Obama's pay czar, and basically he's the person who is Obama appointed to as a result of the TARP passing of the TARP legislation, which is the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and this was created in the aftermath of the economic recession and the downturn in the economy, Lehman Brothers collapse, etc. And all of a sudden, we have Congress coming in and writing legislation to bail out these banks. And as part of this bailout, we needed to actually implement it. The executive branch did, and obviously this is something completely new, and the existing executive branch structure isn't there. So Kenneth Feinberg's position is created as a result of this.
On page 8, you actually get into this, what you've referred to a couple of times, which is a definitional difficulty.
Yes.
And on page 8, you establish your working definition of a czar.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could briefly describe how you reached this decision, this definition, what you then capture in your definition, and what it leaves out, and how it really establishes this foundation on which the research is built.
Great questions. As a big picture issue with the definitional issue with executive branch czars, it's we had to take a step back and try to figure out, what is this phenomenon? And part of it was kind of delving into the history. and you know, just particularly the popular media account of what is a czar. And after that, it was a matter of looking at the political science scholarship out there, the literature on, you know, what is the development, you know, what is the scholarship of development of the executive branch and federal government in general and presidential powers, particularly by the start of the 20th century and going on. And all I have to say is that the phenomenon itself and how we articulated the definition and how we came up with the definition is by tracing that development. And again, it's why historical institutionalism is so useful here, in that you're taking kind of this long view of the history. You know, in my graduate training and reading people like Skowronek, it was immensely helpful with that. And in terms of the developing of the definition, I'll say that the concern that we found, and this is one that helped us with articulating it, was that there seemed to be, since the early 20th century, and this wasn't just seemed to, you know, that all evidence point to this, is that as the executive branch developed and grew, you had certain entities within it that were given more and more power, either through statute or through presidential decree. And it led to an accountability question. And you see this in fits and spurts within things like the White House Authorization Act of 1978. And eventually we've said the phenomenon itself is manifested through the appointment power, that the nominees, or not the nominees, the officials of concern for Congress at various points of times, or who the media labels as czar, are really concerned because of that accountability question. And that gets into the whole idea of developing what does the appointments clause mean, and so on from there. Now, in terms of the definition of czars itself, it's really predicated on the issue of Senate confirmation, that executive branch czar typically means, under our definition, is an executive branch official who is not confirmed by the Senate and is exercising this final decision-making authority. And that authority actually entails, for instance, controlling budgetary programs, coordinating policy areas, promulgating rules, regulations. It doesn't include the definition itself. It doesn't include positions, specific positions. And that's something actually Congress has struggled with. Now, this is particularly true during the Roosevelt administration, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, where Congress was concerned with the growth of the executive branch and the kind of wholesale giving away of its legislative prerogatives to the president. And there were a number of pieces of legislation that tried to at least bring accountability back into the executive branch. And one of the ways they were going to do that was this wholesale reclassification of public officials, how they were appointed, as opposed to being purely presidentially appointed, such and such officials, depending on, you know, who they decided to name in the bill, would be Senate confirmed. And we stayed away from that. So we weren't classifying heads of agencies or certain, you know, we didn't do that. We tried to make it a part of their function to describe what we're talking about in terms of executive branch czars, not necessarily that every single line officer of a department needs to be Senate confirmed.
Now, you start much of this discussion in the progressive movement. In chapter two, you're describing the progressive movement. And you write, as a result, the progressives worked to break the hold of democratic controls on the presidency and favored a bureaucracy within the executive branch staffed by national experts, free from congressional fetters. How does this famous American political movement fit into your explanation of czars? Is the progressive movement where it all starts, or is it simply accelerated during that time period?
Well, I think the triumph of progressive movement is what was accomplished during World War I, and that was to place within the executive branch certain government officials who didn't have that traditional accountability to Congress, and that were really not even authorized by a congressional statute. And I think that's one of the side issues with the definition of czars, is that although it's not a definitional component of how we describe the term, it is an important feature, is this is lack of statutory authorization. Getting back to your question on the progressive era, certainly the progressives didn't create czars. We didn't claim that in the book in terms of tracing their history. Czars date back at least to the to George Washington's administration, but those are what I would classify, and we don't use this term in the book, but kind of foreign-related czars. So they were these special ambassadors. And so during the course of the 19th century, we had presidents appointing special ambassadors for special projects. And it wasn't until the start of the 20th century that you had domestic czars. And that was, you know, Woodrow Wilson's administration, where they manifest themselves. And the progressive movement, you know, the if you want to at least trace back its ideological forebears, I would really say the civil service reformers, starting right after the Civil War, the progressive owe a lot to them. And where civil service reformers were saying, you know, we need to take politics out of appointments, we need to get rid of patronage, and really the way to do that was to trust the executive branch. And eventually that occurs where you get rid of the confirmation process for a bunch of different classes of public officials, and really all of the discretionary decision-making is happening by the presidents or heads of departments and agencies. So once you get to the progressive era, it's only one small step where you can get to the point where executive branch czars can be created without much pushback from Congress.
Now, one could read about halfway through the book and say to oneself, so what?
Yes.
Maybe these czars are technically unconstitutional, but what harm have they really done? And you answer this question in page 69 in the description of FDR's use of czars during World War II to address those of Japanese ancestry. I wonder if you can tell that story and relate that really powerful anecdote for those that sort of offer the argument that, well, no harm is really being done. They're solving problems the same way anyone else would solve problems.
Yeah, it's actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because the issue of the Japanese internment camps and the curfew laws that were put in place and czars, interwove the story of those two things. So obviously anybody who teaches, a public law scholar and teaches a con law class will go through and teach and review Korematsu, you know, the famous Japanese mm-hmm. internment case. And I think we go through that case and we say this is a black mark on the Supreme Court's legacy, where it put its stamp of approval on something that most Americans will look at with disgust, which is, you know, the rounding up of individuals without any cause just based on their national origin. And, you know, this wasn't completely a culpability of the executive branch. You know, Congress did pass laws to this respect, saying, you know, the president has the authority to do this. However, you know, in terms of the execution of it, what occurred was Roosevelt needed, aside from his, you know, General DeWitt, some administrative oversight. And that's something that wasn't in existence within the executive branch. So through executive, again, for the lack of a better word, fiat, there was no congressional authorization, nothing in the Constitution that allows for this. He created a czar, which, you know, I don't think many know, but it was actually the brother of future President Eisenhower. And, you know, the czar of the Japanese Roundup, you know, he provided the administrative oversight to accomplish this task. And he could do it any way he wanted to without any kind of accountability. And obviously there was no accountability coming from the courts and certainly not from Congress. And I think this gets to another point, and you'll probably bring it up anyways, is that much of what we've experienced with the executive branch czars over the course of the 20th century and into this century has been a abdication of institutional responsibilities of Congress, where they notice what's going on and they don't do anything, or if they try to do something, it's relatively unproductive reforms. And most of the political science scholarship in this vein focuses on the aftermath of the imperial presidency in Nixon's administration, where you have the War Powers Resolution being passed and it really doesn't do much in terms of Congress regaining its war power authority. The same applies here, which is that even if Congress is aware of a problem, if they see this as a problem, they don't do anything, or if they do something, it's not particularly effective.
Now, and actually sort of to continue this historical move and to follow up on that, in Chapter 6, you get to some of the later time periods, and you say that Reagan, Bush, and Clinton did not completely revive the pre-Watergate presidential use of czars. Why was this the case? We don't typically think of the Bill Clinton White House and Ronald Reagan's White House as sharing much in common, but in this case, they do share this. At least there was use of czars, but not to the extent of those that went before and to some extent those that came later. So what is it that binds these three administrations together in this way?
Well, you know, I'll take a step back first and say the height of the czars within the mid-20th century presidents was Nixon. I could count the number. I believe he had 13, we say. And then after that, obviously, you have the backlash to the imperial presidency, so Ford and Carter have none. And it was a slow revival. And Shirley Warshall, in her excellent book on the president's cabinet, mentions there was this continued backlash and opposition to presidential power going not only into Ford, Carter, but also Reagan's, the first Bush, and Clinton's. And so Reagan, Bush, and Clinton were all experiencing this. So that's one of the explanations we give. But we also give explanations for the lack of czars and the slow revival, just particular issues that are special for each president. So, for instance, Reagan, he had a, you know, in a lot of scholarship on the unitary executive theory focuses on Reagan and how he saw the need to revive the presidency, particularly after the pushback to the imperial presidency during the mid to late 70s. But his revival of the presidency and presidential power never took the form of czars. He saw czars, if you will, as a way to diminish presidential power. And we explain in the Reagan section this particular story of how Congress wanted Reagan to have a drug czar. And throughout Reagan's initial, his first term and into his second term, he's always in opposition. He's saying no, 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 no. And and only at the end does he actually sign the law that creates this quote-unquote drug czar. And he only does that because it would help out his vice president in the upcoming election. And this is something that Bush didn't want hanging over him as a weapon that the Democrats could use, where, you know, the Bush is soft on drugs and crime and you know, Bush and Reagan oppose the creation of a drug czar that can do something about drugs in America. So it was only at the very end of his presidency that Reagan finally gives in to congressional demands. And then, you know, for Bush, George H.W. Bush, he saw the role of the cabinet as something that was important. And Warshaw documents this, and we're going off of her scholarship. So creating executive branch czars during his administration, he felt like the power, at least is what we're arguing, his actions show that the power center should be within the departments. And then finally with Clinton, there's various issues within his administration that really just prevented the creation of czars. I mean, he did create a couple, but I mean, there were scandals going on. He initially wanted to make any kind of substantial public policy reform efforts through law. I mean, that's with his health care reform. And then really he was mired from the middle of his presidency until the end through impeachment, you know, the Kenneth Starr investigation. It's just a slow walk to the end of his presidency where there wasn't much he could do, obviously. And then, of course, all of the foreign policy concerns he had. So.
And you then continue the story up through the contemporary time period, and I think we'll let people who read the book, get the punchlines to those. But at the end of the book, you sort of circle back and you make some proposals for reform. I wonder if you could summarize those proposals, or at least describe one of the proposals in particular that you think could be adopted without too much wrangling, that would help to right this ship that you have described in the previous chapters.
Oh yikes! my confidence in there not being too much wrangling in D.C. is not overwhelming. So.
Right. This is some wrangling, not extreme wrangling.
Okay. I think the one reform proposal that I would like to highlight, and I think it's important for not just presidential scholars, but political science in general to know, is that, you know, there is controlling legal authority for the executive branch, in particular the White House or the executive office of the president. And most people know the story of how, you know, the executive office of the president was created. You know, FDR said he, you know, needed help, so he creates the Brownlow Committee, and Lewis Brownlow famously says the president needs help, which leads to the Reorganization Act of 1939, which creates, or at least allows Roosevelt to create the executive office of the president. And the executive office of the president is currently what is the administrative apparatus for all the different White House offices and structures, agencies, OMB, is it within it that you see today. And whenever you give that diagram, if anybody teaches, you know, Intro to American Government or whatnot, if you give the diagram when you teach the presidency chapter of all the different offices, that's what the EPO is, Executive Office of the President. But what we say as a reform, to get back to that, is that Congress needs to take another look at that law. And the last time they revamped it was in 1978 with the White House Authorization Act. And basically what it is, it's a revamping of Title III of the United States Code. And Title III is where you find everything to deal with really the White House and executive office of the president. And the reason we say it needs to be revamped is that really some of the assumptions made about the law haven't been borne out. For instance, there were actually pretty strict reporting requirements for the president that were placed on the president that were stricken or taken out during the conference committee. And basically what the conference committee report says is that, well, you know what, the Carter administration promised that these things would happen. These things haven't happened. And what I'm getting at are certain reporting requirements. We don't even know how many individuals are in the executive office of the president, let alone a rough guesstimation. I mean, it's pure speculation. You know, some people, you hear numbers of 500 within the White House office, 5,000 within the executive office of the president. That's really speculation because the reporting requirements are pretty thin. And what we suggest is let's just have a basic accounting of what's going on in the executive branch, particularly within the executive office of the president. And so much policymaking happens in the executive office of the president. And for the public, in particular political scientists, to not have that information to study and to write articles and books to help lawmakers and public officials approve, you know, how government functions and how we promulgate public policy is just, it's a travesty. So I would, again, it's just, it's focusing on Title III and to see some reforms happen by Congress. And I think there should be bipartisan support for that. Again, I'm not as confident in that as I was maybe a couple years ago, but I think that's the start. I think that really is. And it might not even be about bringing accountability where there are individuals who we classify as czars, turn them into Senate-confirmed public officials. More than anything else, the start is to just figure out what's going on, and we don't know that.
The irony here is that probably the only way for this to get done is to appoint a czar in order to take on this issue, which would certainly confound the problem.
Well, yeah, Congress is, that's their proclivity, right? I mean, instead of them doing the heavy lifting, they created the 9/11 Commission, and the 9/11 Commission was given access to all these documents, and they had the institutional knowledge, and then you have the Bush administration claiming executive privilege, or at least claiming some of their White House aides and officials aren't going to be able to testify before Congress, but they're allowed to testify before this 9/11 commission. So,
the commissions are the corollary on Capitol Hill of the czars. Mitch, thank you very much for your time today. Mitch Sullenberger and Mark Rozelle are the authors of The President's Czars, Undermining Congress and the Constitution, new 2012 from University of Kansas Press. I hope that everyone has a chance to pick this book up. I think that you'll learn a lot. Mitch, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.